Welcome to the AC Podcast. This is Terry Crosby.
Andy Steiger.
Andy, today happens to be the 4th of July there, buddy.
It does.
You are American.
How do you celebrate? I was born in Redding, California, and grew up in Portland, Oregon. And the way that we celebrated 4th of July was you'd go down to your local fireworks stand and you would buy as many fireworks as you could afford, and then you'd bring them home and wait until 4th of July. And then we would go out in our front driveway and we would let them off. That was kind of...
So was there a show going on tonight at the Steiger House?
No, there's not.
You know, my wife is American. I think I should implement Independence Day at our house this week.
You know, one of the things that caught me by surprise coming and living in Canada is Canadians only let off fireworks at Halloween. So
yeah,
even for their, you know, National Day, no fireworks, just
no
Halloween.
Fireworks, yeah. Well, we do have a guest on the line today, and she is from the States, and we'll talk to her in just a minute or so. I just want to give you a little idea of about her. This is Melissa Kane Travis. She worked as a bench scientist in the fields of biotechnology and pharmaceutical research for 5 years after obtaining her Bachelor of Science in General Biology from Campbell University. Melissa earned a Master's of Arts in Science and Religion from Biola University in 2012, graduating with highest honors. She is certified in Christian apologetics by Biola and has spent more than a decade exploring the science, theology, and philosophy related to the origins debate. Melissa has served as an assistant professor of Christian apologetics at Houston Baptist University, where she's been on faculty since 2013. Melissa is pursuing a PhD in humanities, focusing on the history and philosophy related to science and mathematical thought in the Western tradition and contemporary scholarship. She is the author of Science and the Mind of the Maker, What the Conversation Between Faith and Science Reveals About God, which we are discussing today and was just released yesterday. Thanks so much for coming on the podcast, Melissa.
Hey, guys. Thank you for the invitation.
Now, you're a fellow American living in Houston?
That's right. I'm actually in a northern suburb called the Woodlands, so I'm not in the big concrete jungle of Houston. We have lots and lots of trees and green where I am, which I need for the health of my soul.
I can appreciate that. And how do you guys celebrate 4th of July? Do you go buy a bunch of fireworks and let them off?
We do. We do it in our backyard, actually, because we're introverts. So we don't venture out to the big community-wide parades and all the other shenanigans.
You know, one time I went to Washington, D.C. for their fireworks show, which I think it was something like 500,000 people. And
wow.
Yeah, I can't handle crowds either, and that just about did me in. But it's great to have you on the show, and we're looking forward to talking about your new book.
Yeah, before we dive into your new book, I just want to highlight and talk about briefly just a few things about Melissa. Back in April of 2015, there was a cover story of Christianity Today called The Unexpected Defenders. And it was you and it was Nancy Piercy, Mary Jo Sharp, Holly Ordway on the cover of CT. Also in 2015, April... Melissa was featured in an article called The Apologist Mom on Hermeneutics. I just want to tease this out a bit about women in apologetics. Mary Jo said that in her blog one time that more women are searching for female apologetic role models, and they're encouraged when they see that happen. Do you find that more and more women are discovering the importance of studying apologetics and what Mary Jo calls the life of the mind?
Oh, absolutely. I began teaching a Sunday school class, apologetics-based material, at my former church where I taught for about 6 years. And it was so encouraging to me that many women would show up for this class having no idea at first what it was. But then as we delved into things like arguments for the existence of God or objective morality, seeing how excited they became because they realized that all of a sudden they had these extra tools that they could use in conversation with skeptical family members, skeptical colleagues, to answer the really hard questions that their children were coming to them with. And I have to say, a lot of them tended to get even more excited and enthusiastic about the subject matter than even the male members of the class. And then outside of that experience, I've gotten email after email after email from women who have discovered my blog, maybe by sheer accident, and write to me in appreciation, just saying, you really encouraged me to understand apologetics as something that's open to women, that we can learn these things too, and we can apply them in our lives in a very fruitful way. And recently in conversation with Hank Hanegraaff, we were talking about this kind of new phenomenon of women in apologetics. And one of the things I emphasized was that we're made in the image of God, but we're made as a complement to men who are also made in the image of God. And I see that as meaning we have complementary voices to bring to any subject we talk about. Mm-hmm. So if apologetics was all about men teaching or men writing, then it would be a deficient project, I think. The feminine voice brings an extra and unique perspective to the subject of apologetics, which I think is desperately needed.
Yeah, that is for sure. We agree with that. Also, we just want to, I think you feel there's an important element in introducing apologetics to kids at a young age. You authored the Young Defenders Apologetics Storybook Series. How do we know God is really there? How do we know God created life? How do we know Jesus is alive? How do we know right from wrong? So how do you feel that apologetics has helped in raising your children, or what are the benefits in integrating that into their learning?
Well, that project kind of came about by accident. When I was a graduate student at Biola studying science and religion, my older son, who was 7 years old at the time, came to me one day out of the blue and just said, "Hey, Mommy, how do we know that all this stuff about God in the Bible isn't just made up like all the other storybooks that we read? How do we even know God is real?" And I'm very thankful that I was where I was in my adult learning, because 10 years before that, I never would have been able to give him a decent or satisfactory answer, even at a 7-year-old level. So that inspired me to start thinking more and more about being able to engage kids at their level, but with a respect for their intellect as well. So that day in conversation with my son, I was able to break down for him what's called the Kalam cosmological argument and do it in language that he understood. And it was wonderful to see the little light bulb go on for him. And I was so thankful and just praised God afterwards for that conversation, because it was the first of many in which I could demonstrate the reasonableness of the Christian faith to him. And so as I raise my boys, my older is now 15, my younger is 11. I love that they get to grow up in a home where the life of the mind is highly valued and Christianity is considered intellectually responsible of a worldview. So I am also gratified by the feedback I've gotten from other parents who have begun integrating apologetics into their home devotionals or their homeschooling, or who have simply bought my books because they had cute illustrations and ended up having awesome conversations with their kids about apologetics topics. So I'm very glad to have done that project. I don't know if I will do more children's apologetics books in the future, but I'm very pleased with the fruit of this one.
Yeah, I have two boys as well. They're 9 and 10. And the importance of being able to engage with your children is just crucial, if not just to, you know, set a precedent for them that there are answers and that you'll help them find those answers. I remember growing up, and I love my mom and she's great, but there weren't a lot of resources out, you know, when I was younger, and I would ask my mom all sorts of questions, and she would often say to me, "Andy, oh man, I wish I could just pay a scientist to talk with you for an afternoon," or, you know, whatever that might be. And I remember thinking, man, if I could only get a hold of of a scientist or whatever it might be. But there are so many great resources out now and available for parents to help them dialogue with their kids and start that sort of precedent that there are answers and we will help them to find them. I want to transition into your book, actually, as a great resource. Terry and I read it on Kindle. It just recently came out, right, Terry?
Yeah, yesterday.
Yesterday.
Yeah.
It is a great book, Melissa. You are an excellent writer. Terry and I read a lot of books here and talk to a lot of authors, and that's not always the case. So I'm happy to say that it is very well written and easy to read. The book is Science in the Mind of the Maker. I'd like to just start out by asking you, how did that title come about?
I'm a big fan of Dorothy Sayers, and for your listeners who aren't familiar with her, she was a good friend of C.S. Lewis. She was a mystery novel writer and also a Christian theologian. And she has a book that has become very famous in the classical Christian education movement, and the title of the book is The Mind of the Maker. And her thesis in the book is that when we read a great work of literary art, something very special happens. There is a sort of path of communication that's opened up between the mind of the reader and the mind of the author, so that through the work of literary art, the reader learns at least something about the mind of the maker of that literary work. And when I read that, I immediately thought of my intellectual hero, Johannes Kepler, who said, when we do science, or he didn't use the word science, it hadn't been coined yet, but he said, when we do natural philosophy, investigating nature, we're essentially thinking God's thoughts after him. And I thought, what Dorothy Sayers is saying about literary art in a reader by analogy is very true about the creator of the world and the human scientist. We're able to read something of God's mind in what he has made. We're able to perceive his high intellect, in other words. And that inspired me to name the book Science and the Mind of the Maker.
Now, you refer to something called the Maker Thesis. Could you tease that out?
The idea behind the Maker Thesis is that we can look at a broad range of disciplines, such as philosophy of mind, biochemistry, neurobiology, earth sciences, cosmology, astrophysics. And the very peculiar thing is, as we investigate these very diverse areas of scientific study, we see them all seeming to point beyond themselves to something transcendent. Because not only do we see a rationality in nature through some of these disciplines, but we also see that things have converged in an amazing way to make science even possible in the first place. So at the end of the day, with all of that said, it seems very much as if we live in a rational cosmos that was meant to be investigated by creatures with higher rationality. And that's what I term the Maker Thesis.
Now, I want to come back to that in a little bit here and go deeper into that, because I think that's such an important point. But before we do that, I want to talk about an area about with regards to science and religion that maybe some of our listeners just have as kind of a roadblock to even have a conversation on this idea of having science and a maker and getting to know God through science. Because a lot of people have grown up with a very fragmented view of religion and science that was inspired in many ways from Stephen Jay Gould and others, this non-overlapping magisterium in which you have facts on one side and you got values on the other, and they should never talk to each other. And that these are really two different realms, science and religion. How do you bridge that gap and help people to understand the difference between science and religion, but also how the two work together?
Well, I think first and foremost, it's important to talk about epistemology, and the average layperson is going to have no idea what you're talking about when you use that $5 word. But I explained to them, it really boils down to the kinds of things we can come to know when we're doing science, and at what point do the things we say about our scientific data or our findings of our experimentation and investigation, at what point does what we say about those things overlap into, or a better way to say it might be cross over into, the realm of philosophy? And I explained that we can do our science with no, I guess bias is the best word that comes to mind, about any religious persuasion one way or the other. But then once the science is all said and done, we can look at it and we can ask really important philosophical and theological questions, such as, is what we're observing pointing beyond just the natural world? Do we see something in nature that seems to imply that the fundamental stuff of the cosmos is not blind matter and energy, but intelligence? And so rather than seeing science and religion as non-overlapping magisteria, as Gold argued, we can say, well, religion can get us so far and science can get us so far, but in the areas where they overlap, there's this wonderful synergy that happens where the questions that they address together, such as questions about origin, become all that much richer because we now not only know that the how it happened, but we also know the why it happened and who initiated it. So it's just, as Alistair McGrath would say, it's a much more coherent and intellectually satisfying view of the world.
One of the things that I notice as well is that in science itself, there are different levels with regards to science. So in one area, you can have pure science, say in the area of physics, but yet you can have applied science in the area of engineering. And it's interesting when you see that in the area of, say, applied science, that the engineer really does have this kind of understanding that, yeah, you can have the laws of nature and they follow nature's laws, but yet you can impose your own laws on those parts to create things like a bridge. And so even there in the science, you can see the effect that a person has on the natural world and in that area of science. You following me with that?
Yes, and I think that that is one thing we can point to when it comes to discussing the image of God in man and man being equipped to actually do science, whether it's the pure science or the applied science. So that, I think that's a beautiful point.
Now, maybe before we go too much further, I realize it's a fairly complicated question, but how are we even defining science? And where do you go as you lay down that basic foundation of what are we even talking about?
Oh, well, for the purposes of science and the mind of the maker, the way I'm defining science is surely the empirical investigation of the natural world. And when I use the word empirical, I don't necessarily mean things that are observable with the naked eye or with special instrumentation that helps us observe something. And by that, I mean like telescopes or microscopes or what have you. But anything that we do to take measurements, to investigate the nature of nature. There's actually a really awesome anthology called The Nature of Nature, but I love that phrase, the nature of nature. In other words, what is nature like? What is it fundamentally? And so that's how I think of science. But then you notice that within that definition, we really can't get to, well, what does it all mean? And how does it all really fit together in terms of the kind of place in which we live? So that's just a rough definition of how I'm defining it for the purposes of the book.
So on the one hand, you got science, and one of the other things you bring up in the book is scientism. What do you mean by scientism?
So there are actually various degrees of what I'm calling scientism, but roughly speaking, scientism is this view that the only way we can come to know anything with any certainty at all is through the empirical sciences. So if you're using any other method to quote unquote know something, then you're not really pursuing authentic knowledge. So the hard proponent of scientism would say questions that fall within the realm of disciplines such as theology and philosophy are utterly meaningless because these aren't things that we can observe and test using the scientific method. So it's a very narrow epistemology, and it rules out so much that we actually depend upon for our human existence. One of the examples I often give is morality. We can't find morality in a test tube. So the hardcore proponent of scientism is stuck because he has to bite the bullet if he's going to be consistent in his worldview and say, oh, there's no such thing as objective morality because that isn't something that we can test scientifically.
One of the things that you actually wrote in your book that I thought was interesting is you called this that scientism is expensive. And
right.
And this is what you're getting at. Look at the cost that this is going to entail.
Right, exactly. It's very expensive in the sense of how much you have to give up in the very limited realm that you're calling certain knowledge or likely knowledge.
Throughout your book, you develop arguments for the maker, and you use natural theology. Can you define that for us, and how does that get us to a transcendent being who made the universe?
So over the years, natural theology has been defined in a few different but similar ways. The way I normally explain it to someone who's never heard the phrase before is that natural theology is the discipline concerned with what we can learn about God without using any book of special revelation, any inspired word of scripture, in other words. So in Romans 1:20, for example, the Apostle Paul talks about how through what has been created, we can see God's wisdom and power. So that would be a quintessential example of what we're doing when we do natural theology. We're looking at the world around us, but we're also, and I don't really talk about this in the book, but we're also looking at human nature. We're observing what are some universal characteristics of human nature, and do those tell us anything at all about the existence of a transcendent maker of humanity? But in the book, Science and the Mind of the Maker, I'm mostly concerned with this practice of looking at nature and deciding, can we see anything in these different scientific disciplines that seems to point to a transcendent creator?
So one of the arguments in your chapters is the fine-tuning argument. So this would be natural theology. Can you explain that? Because I think it's quite a good argument.
Yeah, it's one of my favorites. And I've actually heard a few skeptics admit that they believe it's one of the stronger arguments, not that they believe the conclusion, but right. They think it's one of the stronger arguments. A good example of that would be Dr. Bradley Montan. I believe he's at University of Colorado. He has a book where he defends intelligent design from an atheist perspective. At any rate, the fine-tuning argument deals with the fact that the quantities and constants of nature seem to be extraordinarily finely tuned in order to make the existence of life possible. So what we mean by constants and quantities are numbers, values that either were in place at the moment the universe first came into existence, or we talk about the measurements that we have to make for the constants that get plugged into the laws of nature. So these numbers seem arbitrary. And the reason they seem arbitrary is because they're not numbers that are the result of the mathematical laws themselves. They're not numbers that could ever be calculated from the laws of nature, in other words. Instead, they're things that have to be measured, but they turn out to be constant. And we can plug them in every single time we're trying to determine something like gravitational force. We have the gravitational constant, which has to be plugged in to the equation in order to arrive at the mathematical conclusion that we're trying to find. So there are many of these parameters that seem to be very finely tuned. In other words, if they deviated just a hair's breadth, but less than a hair's breadth, stronger or weaker, higher or lower, then the cosmos would not have the nature it has. And as a result, there would never have been any kind of life anywhere at any time in the universe.
So, I mean, we could add some other arguments to this, like the cosmological argument, the Kalam cosmological argument, or the moral argument. I mean, in your book, you talk about the coherence of the maker thesis, and you give an analogy of a wooden peg puzzles. Can you give us a picture of how that kind of all fits together to give a good explanation for the Christian faith?
Right. So for those who are listening, who are parents, you've probably seen one of those really cool wooden peg puzzles before, where you have this wooden tray with relief cutouts in it in different shapes, and then the little wooden puzzle pieces that have a peg handle on them that you're able to pick up the piece with and put it in the correctly shaped hole. And the interesting thing about these peg puzzles is that most of the time, the board itself that has the cutouts in it has a background image, and the places with the cutouts are blank. So it's not until you put each individual peg puzzle piece into its respective hole that you get the full picture that you're supposed to have. But when the pieces are out of the tray, the wooden base of the puzzle, you can see little indications around their edges of where they might fit in the puzzle. But more importantly, you see indications that they are part of a larger whole in some respect. So I use that as an analogy for the maker thesis, because when we look at all the different scientific and philosophical disciplines that I address in the book, we see that if we put them all together, they tend to form this beautiful, coherent whole that makes an enormous amount of sense on the Christian worldview or even just a theistic worldview. But when you say, oh, no, no, they're not united in this worldview, then you're left with these fragments of reality that seem to go together, but you're saying, no, they do not. They do not point to a common transcendent cause, a common transcendent mind. And even though it's very lucky that they all happen to produce conditions favorable for doing the natural sciences, well, that's just a big lucky cosmic accident. So I think at the end of the day, as the peg puzzle illustration shows, it's a much more intellectually satisfying paradigm when we say, no, there is a transcendent maker who arranged things this way for a very specific purpose, so that humanity, made in his image, could come to know something about his existence and his mind.
On that analogy, using the puzzle, there is some interesting rules that are imposed often on science. And you pick up on this, and I was thankful you did in your book towards the end, and you see it throughout, but the idea of physicalism. And it's interesting, these imposed rules, such as physicalism, and what it, you know, the interesting problems that it presents. And here you see a puzzle that really, through these different rules, all of a sudden becomes incoherent in many ways. Because I really feel like this topic of physicalism is really misunderstood in our culture today, or not fully appreciated. And so, like I was saying, that's one thing I really appreciated that you brought up in the book, because as I interact with different scholars, this is something that I continually see, is this idea of physicalism. And some of you talk about the expense, you know, and as you know, one of the expenses is determinism. And in one of your chapters, you talk about, you know, mind versus the marionette. Could you talk about that, you know, the expense there of physicalism?
So, of course, there are counter-arguments and counter-arguments and counter-arguments against the argument that I make in the book. In a popular level book, you only have so much space and you can only go to so much depth before the popular level reader is going to zone out and stop reading. This is something my publisher had to really hammer into my brain, especially with this chapter and also the chapter on mathematics.
And I'm guessing you're talking about non-reductive physicalism and its various counterparts from emergentism to supervenience.
Right. Yes, exactly. So you can get lost in the jungle very, very fast, especially if it's not an area you've done any reading whatsoever in before.
And I have to confess, it is complex.
Yes, yes. So with that said, I had to simplify it a great deal. But my position in the book is that if physicalism is true, in other words, if all that exists in reality is the physical stuff of the universe, then that leads to some very dire consequences for us. For example, determinism seems to be true if physicalism is true. And when I say determinism, what I mean is not that if every particle in the universe were known and accounted for and all the laws of nature could be applied by some super intellect or supercomputer, then we could deterministically predict all of the physical future. I don't mean it in that respect. Rather, I mean everything is determined by its physical substrate, I guess is a good word. So in other words, there might be some chance involved in the physical world, especially at the subatomic level. We could get all into quantum theory there, but rather, there is no such thing as free will if everything that goes on in our brain is physically determined. So when I do a math problem or when I write a story or something like that, then essentially this is just the result of my brain chemistry. There's not a real self who's doing the rational activity that's required for those things. And so that infringes on lots of different areas, not just the question of human rationality, but also the question of human morality. Because if at the end of the day, everything we do and say is the result of brain chemistry we have no control over, then we really aren't accountable for anything that we ever say or do. It's just a brute fact of nature. So in that respect, physicalism, which seems to lead to determinism, leads to big problems when it comes to the kind of rationality that we need in order to ever do science in the first place. I gave the example a minute ago of mathematics. So when we do complex mathematics, especially the kind that's involved with fields such as theoretical physics, there's a lot of judgment that goes into doing that kind of mathematics step by step. And so if determinism were true, if it was just all a matter of our brain chemistry doing its own thing without any input from a transcendent self, then how could we ever say that what's happening is genuinely rational? So that leads to different arguments. C.S. Lewis talked about the argument from reason, and there have been different iterations of that particular argument, but the one I like the most says, we know that we have rationality, and the success of the natural sciences is a huge indicator that we have genuine rationality. But genuine rationality and this idea of physicalism and physical determinism, they're not compatible with each other for the reasons that I described.
Yeah, I just got one more point I want to bring up within your book. It has to do with the Genesis creation account, and that deals with the age of the earth, the biological history, the universal common descent. You state in your book, you say the maker thesis transcends those kinds of discussions and instead focuses on the attention of the higher essential, the existence of a creator of all things in whose image man is fashioned. You label it mere creation. I thought that was an interesting point in how we get past that kind of talks within the Christian circles that are hot topics, I guess, how it kind of oversteps that and goes right to the creator, I guess you'd say.
Right. So in my experience over the past decade and a half, I guess it's been now, it tends to be counterproductive to get bogged down in those discussions on the secondary issues. They're very much in-house conversations. And I tend to be a bit troubled by the fact that they're used in Christian apologetics more broadly speaking. In other words, they're used in Christian apologetics in the evangelistic sense, when these are very much in-house discussions that are very, very secondary to the big issues that we should be focusing on when it comes to talking with those who are skeptical of the Christian worldview. So my mere creation philosophy of scientific apologetics is, let's focus on the big issues that we first have to tackle in order to get someone to open their mind to the reality of Jesus Christ. So first of all, they're never going to be open to this idea that God became man and dwelt among us if they don't believe in the existence of God in the first place. So the maker thesis is very interested in the existence of God, but it goes beyond just theism in that it also argues, not only does it seem very much as if there's a transcendent creator of the world and of human beings, but it seems very much as if we have some sort of intellectual kinship with this maker, that he made us in such a way that we could see hints of him in the natural world.
Well, Melissa, thank you so much for spending time with us today. We sure appreciate your book and your insight into all those matters.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. This was fun.
Where can people find you at on the net?
On the net. I have an author page on Facebook that's just under my name, Melissa Kane Travis. I'm on Twitter as Tex Apollo Chick. And I also have a blog. My blog doesn't get as much attention lately as I wish it did because of my studies. But I do have a blog that's just melissatravis.com.
And if people want to pick up your book, they can do so, I'm guessing, at their local bookstore, Amazon. It is available on Kindle and iBook. Anything
right,
else
that
we're missing?
Right, and Barnes & Noble as well.
Good. It was a great book, and we thank you for writing it, for sure.
Thank you for the encouragement. I really appreciate that.
Thank you for joining us, listeners. The AC Podcast is a ministry of Apologetics Canada, and we'll be back next week with more things to think about.